cue for that. That nice little digging sound right there. What's up, guys? We're here. It's the third weekend of March. We are here to review an A24 movie, the first major A24 drop of the year. I know Problemisa had sort of like a limited release after it was supposed to come out August last year, but we have our first official big A24 movie of the year that they've been putting some marketing behind. I'd actually be interested to see like how many people actually are aware of this, especially if this fits into their whole, oh, we're going to try and be more mainstream message, that being Love Lies Bleeding from director Rose Glass, who directed St. Maud, which is one of the worst movies I've ever seen back in 2020. Whoa. This is definitely, I will say, a little bit better. I'm joined once again by Kristen, a.k.a. Miss Flamingo, and my friend Nathaniel Ahart. Happy to have you guys here.
It's happy good to be here, Dom.
Oh, man. Perfect unison, as I always love it. And at the end, we're going to be talking about Invincible as well, just for a quick quick little powwow there, because Invincible, after a three-month gap, is finally back for in order to air the last four episodes of season two. And we're going to talk and see if these long gaps in between these really good and well-acclaimed shows are really, really starting to hurt it. All of that and more on tonight's episode of the Talking TV Podcast. Stay tuned. All right, people, what is going on? We are back, like I said. So after pretty crazy, pretty hectic 2 weeks, we had obviously the phenomenon that was Dune 2 finally was released, and then we had the Oscars to talk about all last week, quite a lot to talk about there. So now we're getting back to sort of a regular content schedule, in the year of 2024, which I just wanted to gauge your guys' thoughts real quick about the year of 2024 so far, because I believe this is the first episode for the new year that I've had both of you on for so far. So I just want to do a quick powwow, get your guys' thoughts on 2024. Obviously, we're seeing the results of the strike, really. We had two straight months of either pretty much dog shit or stuff that like just people just didn't want to watch. And then, obviously, Dune 2 comes out, and it kind of sparks this, like, big phenomenon. The fact that it's kind of like, kind of the next big major cinematic event, and then everything going on with the Oscars. So I just wanted to get your guys' thoughts on that. Start with Nathaniel. What are your thoughts on 2024 so far and for the year?
Man, this year is cooking. I saw a few movies last year that come out quite yet. One's coming out this upcoming week, and I think this is on track to surpass 2023, which I already think is one of the greatest years in all of cinema. Between Dune Part 2 and like all this stuff, and maybe the movie we're going to talk about today, I think filmmakers, like, we need to step it the fuck up after COVID. I don't know what happened those first 3 years. 2022 started to get a little bit better, where I was like, okay, but this isn't the level I want it to be. Then last year, all hell broke loose, and I think that is already spilling over into this year. So much stuff that's also been running the festival circuits, which haven't been released yet, going in a limited. And I think we're already in for a wealth of riches. I almost have an already great top 10 list, assuming all those movies come out this year. So, yeah, I mean, it's pretty insane. I'm going to be honest. I wouldn't even have 10 movies I really liked in March, let alone one that I love. And I have about, I want to say, 8 movies that I love. So, yeah, this year's gas. Like, it is just straight heat.
Bold words, to say the least. I guess just because the reason why I asked that is because I haven't, again, I miss a decent amount of the festival movies just because of how busy I've been with school and everything. So there were a lot of Sundance movies that I wanted to watch that I unfortunately missed. DD and A Real Pain probably be in the top of the list. And so, yeah, so I'll catch those when those come out later on in the year. But yeah, I guess just as I meant as far as like mainstream content goes, it's been kind of lackluster. Like I said, mostly because the mainstream big stuff that we've gotten has been pretty bad. And also, like I said, the strike has delayed a lot of the stuff. But what is interesting that I found is that they are kind of taking sort of a page of the last couple books, which is the few big things that are coming out, they really are going out of the way to like eventize them, which I think is the smart move. I think that's definitely what draws people out and gets people to, because again, theaters are still having a hard time getting people to show up unless it is something like Dune. But Kristen, so somebody who's kind of a little bit in between me and Nathaniel as far as the stuff that you've been able to see, what are your thoughts so far on the year of 2024?
Well, Nathaniel was really saying that 2024 has been a pretty impressive year so far. I am so happy with the majority of stuff I've seen. I mean, Dune Part 2 is probably the best film I've seen this entire year. I mean, come on, that was a cinematic event. It was an epic, like, film experience event, you know? But I think, like, besides the mainstream stuff, a lot of great indie stuff is going to be released this year, and I'm so excited for, like, audiences to get to see, like, stuff like, you know, Jesse Eisenberg's latest film. That was at Sundance, which I love. Not Sasquatch. Not the Sasquatch movie.
Definitely not Sasquatch. I'm sorry. I saw that trailer when I went to see Problem Lisa, and I'm like, they're fucking with us. They're actually fucking with us, right? This is not a real movie. I'm like, no, they dressed up as Sasquatches and went out to the woods and filmed the whole thing literally and released it as a joke. I'm like, there's no way this is actually real.
My husband thought it was a literal meme. He's like, is this for real? And he's like, I was like, yeah. But no, I love stuff like independent stuff this year, like a great indie film called Pony Boy. I hope that gets released later on this year. I loved, you know, one film that was released in theaters. You can say it's independent, but it's also mainstream. But I loved Lisa Frankenstein, and I wish people gave that more attention because that movie was so camp and I loved it. And it's good. And I'm excited to see what is next for the next few months and going into summer. So, I mean, summer looks okay, but I'm just like, I know we're going to have a great summer with a lot of sweet indie films.
Yeah, that's the thing that I always do kind of look forward to in years like this, where the big kind of tent, well, I mean, even the big tent poles really are like kind of different, because again, the fact that now that we really don't have that many superhero movies coming out, it finally gives like some of the other franchises a chance. And the thing that I've talked about, I don't know if I've got a chance to say it on this show yet, but I think that I have talked about is how a lot of the tentpole movies seem to be dystopian in nature, or leaning towards that, like towards like more disaster epic films, you know, kind of going back to late 90s. Like, you got movies like Twisters, Godzilla and Kong, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, Quiet Place Day One, Civil War, Furiosa, all of these movies that are kind of like, you know, kind of in the background as far as being like, you know, Doomsday, the end is nigh, you know, shit like that. But like I said, yeah, there is, of course, a lot of other good indie stuff as well that I'm looking forward to. Kinds of Kindness as well. The next Yorgos Lanthimos movie. You got a release date, June 21st.
Only my six birthday. Months.
Birthday present.
There you go. That's a great birthday. And not to mention
like the same thing.
If that's not an indicator of how successful Poor Things was, I don't know what is, because the fact that they're only a 6 month gap in between movies. I wasn't expecting Kinds of Kindness until season this year. I'm
that's
shocked.
Like December worthy, you know? Yeah. Take the big risk for the summer. I am proud for Searchlight to, you know, go full force, and
especially,
I will be there to go see it.
Especially since that's the release date slot that they gave to Asteroid City last year. So I'm like, wow, they're really I'm like, they're really going for it now. Nathaniel, if you wanted to run through, what are just some of the movies that you have that you've seen festival wise that have yet to get released
I'm glad you asked.
Yeah,
because I actually wanted to plug a few things. If you guys are on Netflix this week, please check out Andrew Gaji, directed by Regis.
Yes, the one that you saw at TIFF.
Yes, it is like, it's from Indonesia. It is, quite frankly, one of the few masterpieces of the decade I'd put up with Godzilla Minus One and Dune Part Two. It really is such an amazing drama that really, it's so moving, it's so riveting, every single character has depth. It's just one of those movies you have to see and go in as blind as possible, I guess you could say. Amazing director, great guy too, very, very, you know, humble person. And also The Missing, I don't know when this is getting released. I don't know if it is at all this year, but very amazing Filipino rotoscope animated film. Hoping it gets picked up by Netflix, because it was picked up by Netflix in the Philippines. But it's truly, I'd say, up there with Across the Spider-Verse is the best animated movie of the decade. Yeah, it's unbelievable. It's really a revelation. I'm trying to think, because there's a bunch of other stuff too, like at Sundance, I loved Exhibiting Forgiveness.
That was good. Andre, that was a good one.
Yeah. I'm waiting for that one to get a release date.
Yeah, I hope it gets one, but you never know. And also another great documentary that also premiered at Sundance, probably my favorite film I saw at the festival, online at least, and that was Daughters, which Netflix also picked up. So you know, bringing up Netflix the whole time. Yeah. Yep. You got to see it, Kristen?
No, but I was familiar with that one. There was one documentary I watched that I have close relations to.
Yeah, the one movie that I was able to get to watch at Sundance was Little Death, which I did not go in the direction I was expecting.
That movie was something else.
I didn't mind it. I didn't mind it. I would definitely, like I said, did not go in the direction at all that I was expecting it, but I was kind of impressed with how it kind of neatly wrapped up. Also, in a weird way, like the best David Schwimmer performance in over 10 years.
I will say I wanted more, but I actually was kind of excited.
Yeah, that movie took a turn in the middle that I was not expecting.
I loved the first half of that film, and then once we got out,
it was on Dominic Fike and Talia Ryder's character, that's what I'm like, all right.
I'm not a Dominic Fike fan so far, and I'm just okay, whatever.
All right, but let's get to the movie that we're talking about. Like I said, we A24, right? Kind of the start of this whole big indie movement over 10 years ago now that we have officially started. We are in year 11 of A24, which is absolutely insane. The irony being that we're also only 1 week away from the first big neon release of the year, that being Sydney Sweeney's Immaculate, which I'm so immaculately looking forward to for certain reasons. But yeah, so we have, this is the second film from Rose Glass, like I said, directed St. Maud, which again, I was being hyperbolic at the beginning, but yeah, to say that I was not a fan of that movie, I don't think describes it nearly as well as I did. But like I said, A24, they knew what they were doing with the marketing for this movie, to say the least, where almost everything, they got Katie O'Brien, just her arms, like just plastered over every poster, every
gun show.
I'm like, I know what this is. They're going for the muscle mommy crowd. That's what they're going for. Yeah. Here, you know, like, and listen, far be it for me to accuse you, but like the muscle, I feel I'm going to attribute most of this to Rhea Ripley and the work that she's been doing in the WWE, or as I call it, God's work. This really has become like a pretty big trend recently, and like I'm really mad that I don't have Dontre here, because Dontre's the freaking expert when it comes to this stuff. But I do think it's fascinating how they kind of like almost flip this one on their heads, where instead of marketing this as kind of a feminist piece, which it is, they definitely marketed it more to appeal to the male audience, which I think is in a weird way smarter if you think about it, especially when you think that like this movie also, like I will say, this movie does not also subscribe to a lot of the current Hollywood trends, which is that it's also not seeking out to humiliate men, which I appreciated as well. Mm-hmm. I also thought that, like, again, it was more of a just straight up traditional noir. Like, it had all the elements of like really, really good noir filmmaking. And so I just want to kind of just start there. You know, basic breakdown of the premise, where you have Kristen Stewart's character. I gotta look up, because once again, I cannot remember character names to save my own life. Kristen Stewart's character, Lou, who works as a reclusive gym manager at this place. Did they ever say what state they're actually in? They don't actually say what state they're in, but you gotta assume that they're somewhere near Vegas. What's it called? Because Katie M. O'Brien's character, Jackie, who's a rising bodybuilder, homeless, kind of wanders into town, gets a job at the shooting range run by Lou's father. Portrayed by Ed Harris, and she ends up befriending Lou. Lou ends up getting her hooked on steroids, and you know, her and Lou kind of form this relationship as they as she transfers this bodybuilding competition in Vegas. And then, of course, she, you know, you're introduced to the rest of Lou's family, including her sister, Beth, played by Jenna Malone, and her sister's husband, JJ, portrayed by Dave Franco. And certain things transpire that unfortunately cause them to, you know, start to have to clean up their tracks. And that's all that I'm going to say as far as not spoiling it. So, like I said, they knew what they were doing with the marketing, to say the least. So now that we've actually seen the movie, what do you guys think? Kristen, I'm going to start with you.
I thought it was pretty good. I was very impressed. And ironically enough, this premiered at Sundance. So bringing that back up, I was very impressed. I felt like the movie for me was trying to find its footing in the beginning for myself to like really get invested. But once the second major, like, the main event of the film happens, I was like, all right, I'm in. I'm invested. I'm in for this thrill ride. Up until the very like end, which is very different.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that ending when we get to it. Because I have a couple questions.
I enjoyed it, like, for the most part. Yeah. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it, this movie, much more than Rose's previous film. I liked St. Maud, but I loved the style for it. And I knew that when I was like watching, you know, Rose's previous work, I was like, okay, this girl is going to like bring something extreme one day. And she did. And she has style. Mm-hmm. She can bring substance to, and I think now going for any project. And I'm so excited to see what she does next at this point, because she certainly caught my attention pretty much even more now after watching, you know, Love Lies Bleeding.
Most definitely. Yeah, I will say this. Just in terms of comparing this to St. Maud, this is definitely a step up. Like to say, but I kind of figured that from the trailer. Like it was definitely a massive, massive step up and a massive improvement. Like I said, she knows what she's doing filmmaking-wise. She knows how to place the camera. She knows how to like really generate what's the word I'm looking for? She really knows how to set like make a real presence with her filmmaking. Like,
and great, like thrilling moments and like
exactly
where like horror can be presented.
Exactly. Like, you know. And that's the thing too, that I also appreciated about this movie is that even though this movie isn't a horror movie, the way this movie utilized horror elements and like almost like different like body morphing, body horror as well. I thought the way that those elements were utilized, I thought was really, really cool and fascinating. Nathaniel, what did you think?
So, just for context, St. Maud, I enjoyed on some level, but I wasn't necessarily into all the ideas it was presenting, or maybe I didn't agree with it on a personal level. Thought the ending was a bit of a cop-out. But this movie, I heard great things. I was expecting I might love it. But like, I'd say from almost like the first shot of the movie, I was hooked. This was so riveting to watch. I think the character drama is so well written throughout the entire thing. It had me on the edge of my seat, my jaw on the floor, literally, for a good majority of the
time. Literally.
Oh my God.
And I was about to say like this was definitely going to make my top 10 of the year. And look, I mean, I said this many times about movies last year, so I'm not ready to say it is going to be like in my top 10 of this year, but it's definitely a contender. But the only thing that held it back for me, a little split on the ending, because it's kind of crazy. But I appreciated what they were doing with it. I think there's many ways it can be interpreted.
Yeah.
And the more I think about it, the more I love it. I think this film is such a revelation for Rose Glass. And I think one of the best directed movies of the year. Editing-wise, I think it's by far the best edited film of the year.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Sound design's the best I've heard in years. I'd say even better than Zone of Interest. I'm not even kidding. That was one of my favorite movies.
That's a crazy take.
I mean, I don't think so.
That's a crazy take there.
I mean... Listen to the sound design. Listen to how every single second is like amplified because of how present sound is in the mix. And I think it adds to and heightens the experience of the viscerality of this film in a way that I don't think I've heard many other films do in recent memory. So, I hope it gets nominated for those Oscars. I mean, only time will tell, but.
Yeah,
I truly think this is a fantastic, fantastic film and an amazing sophomore effort from Rose Glass.
Absolutely. Yeah, like I said, I really, really enjoyed it. I don't necessarily know if I love it as much as you two did, but I really thought it was solid. And I was impressed, to say the least. I was impressed by how engaged I was. I was impressed with, you know, kind of how it went along. I was impressed with, like I said, the pace really, first and foremost, was probably pretty top-notch because this is... Let me see.
Yeah.
This was 104 minutes, so about an hour and 40. Like I said, that's about A24's sweet spot. A24 very rarely goes over that time length. So that was good. Like I said, just I hate using this word, but I really think it is accurate when it comes to describing it. The vibe that this movie generates, I think, is really, really fascinating. Where this movie has like elements of like Taxi Driver. And then it kind of starts, and then it starts transitioning into the horror and like the random cartoons with the body horror. Like, there's a lot that this movie is trying to say that I think is going to go overlooked, which is, again, the whole idea of like this movie being like a low key, like anti-steroids movie, also, which again, I think is something that is really going to go heavily overlooked. But I got to say, for me, I thought was one of the absolute highlights of the movie. Also, the fact that it kind of, it wore its influences on its sleeve, but not in an obnoxious way. Like, it wasn't... It wasn't trying to do, like, what Joker did, which is where that movie was so obnoxiously obvious about the movies that it was trying to emulate that it really kind of took away from the experience for me, versus this one, again, there's a lot of elements of other movies that I do enjoy, but none of them to the point where it was distracting. And really, it also comes down to the performances. Now, there was a weird thing that happened on my screening, and I do have to point this out. I don't know if this was if you guys had this experience or if this is just my theater, but for whatever reason, the audio of the actual dialogue, not the sound design, that was great, but the actual dialogue when the actors were speaking was so low I could barely hear it. Did you guys have that problem?
No.
That was just a glitch with my theater then. But so that I thought was kind of a little bit distracting. But other than that, like I said, the performances are great. Ed Harris, I mean, is phenomenal. He never disappoints. And he is so good as this guy who is like not as outwardly a villain as I thought he was going to be, but also like, you know, clearly very scary and clearly.
I think this is the craziest we've seen him in hair.
For sure. Yeah. Also, Dave. Also, Dave Franco, again, in the movie for not a lot, but like plays a really good slime.
He's really good.
Yeah, we've been depraved, honestly, of good Dave Franco. Ever since Michael Bay did him so dirty in one of the absolute most bloodiest and unnecessarily bloodiest deaths that I've ever seen in the beginning of Six Underground, I just feel like we've been deprived of good Dave Franco performances. And this one kind of brought it back as like just the ultimate sleazeball of all sleazeballs. But I mean, shout out to, again, Katie O'Brien, who, after suffering last year in two Disney projects that she was way too good for, Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania, and The Mandalorian Season 3, she, like, shines here. And it's been a long time. It's been a long time since... I think what's so interesting about this performance is the fact that it's been so long since we've seen, like, this physical of a performance given from a female performer. I mean, there's probably a bunch more that I'm missing, but I think probably the last time that I remember seeing a performance this physical was probably what Charlize Theron did for Monster is probably the closest that I can think of. But like just the absolute how she's able to match this incredible vulnerability that her character has with this absolute just monstrous appearance, you know, that she kind of leans into. And the fact of how that is utilized, how that is weaponized against her, like the constant like balancing out of like the masculine versus the feminine, I think is another ingenious angle that this movie does, because the whole thing that is established and kind of the basis for her and Kristen Stewart's relationship is the fact that Kristen Stewart also does the steroids, but not nearly as much. And the joke being that I don't work out. So she doesn't put on any muscle. So kind of the different elements of like, you know, even though they're both females, the masculinity versus the femininity and how they kind of like trade off and on. It's very interesting in terms of how that's explored. Another thing as well is the fact of, again, when Katie M. O'Brien, like when her character Jackie is kind of like portrayed as this, it's interesting. She is like kind of this soul, this lost soul that's searching for love and acceptance in a world that clearly has not given her that much. And we really don't know that much about her character. You're like,
get that little bit when she makes that phone call. You know, it's just enough. I wish we kind of got a teensy bit more.
Sure, exactly. I wish that we got a little bit more there. But she is forced to commit these absolutely despicable acts, which... I also do want to talk about the violence in this movie, because the violence does that's another part where I'm still not quite sure, where there are certain moments where like the violence is sickening and shocking, but then there are other moments where it ends up kind of being like treated as a joke. But I don't know if it's like intentionally meant to be funny. And so
Can I bring up something? Yes. When you say that, are we allowed to talk spoilers now?
Let's get the spoiler-free warning out of the way. Let's talk some spoilers.
So to bring up your point of, you know, the horror part, you know, to take itself seriously, the horror comes in immediately when we see what happens to Dave Franco's character. That's when I felt the utter shocks and the chills and oh my gosh, where are we going to go now? Like, what is going to happen? You know, there's blood everywhere. And then, you know, you see it get worse as, you know, with Jenna Malone's character and everything else going on, you know.
There is some really, really good, practical effects done for this. With the makeup. So good, yeah.
Where the horror, though, gets silly is at the very end.
Yeah.
For me.
Yeah.
And I was like, I kind of wanted to stand out of my chair and just be like, where are we going?
Yeah. I had a little bit of question. So save that. Because like I said, the whole, I think we're going to get to. So, I mean, So I guess basically in order to get to give some context, right? So it's established that, like I said, Dave Franco and Jenna Malone are in a pretty abusive relationship. And what's interesting is the way that we're introduced to Jackie's character is that she's in the car having sex with Dave Franco's character so that she can get a job for, what's it called, you know, working at the gun range where he also works for Jenna Malone and Kristen Stewart's father, played by Ed Harris. And so you have that kind of dichotomy that's introduced. He's kind of like this weaselly character, and it's pretty quickly established that, like, you know, they have an abusive relationship. Every time you see Jenna Malone's character, she's got like cuts and bruises and on her face. It's pretty trademark. And Kristen Stewart, again, she's in like kind of like a powerless position. She's like, I want to fucking kill this guy, but I don't. But she knows that like her sister is unfortunately has a very unfortunate, typically victim mentality, which is where she's like, yeah, I, you know, nothing's wrong. Everything is, everything is fine. Everything's copacetic. Oh, he just gets angry. Let's loose a little bit. So like after a certain point, like the way that things are building up, it's like, okay, he's going to die. It's just a matter of when. And it's pretty clear that that's going to be the inciting incident that really kicks it off. But I wasn't expecting that it was going to happen as soon as it did. And I didn't expect that it was going to happen when it did, because, you know, they get a call. She's in the hospital. It's pretty brutal. You know, they see they see her bruised, battered face, and I mean the makeup that they did on Jenna Malone's face for when she's in the hospital.
She looks unrecognizable.
Literally, she looks like who's the guy?
I forgot that was her.
Yeah, who's the guy that they had in both Under the Skin, and he was in that Sebastian Stan movie that also aired at Sundance, the name of which is currently escaping me. But he's the guy, he's got I can't remember the name of the disease that he has, but the thing that makes his face look all kind of like messed up. That's kind of almost like what her face looked like in terms of like after how badly it was bruised. Like it was pretty
half
rough.
Of it, yeah.
Yeah. Well, at least half of it. Yeah. Not the whole thing. Yeah. But, and the fact that like, also like they didn't like show it like going down. Like, yeah, the swelling went down a little bit, but like she has that like throughout the rest of the movie. I'm like, God damn, that's tough. But then you shows Katie, Jackie walking out of the hospital. She gets to the truck. You know what she's going to do. You know, you cut to Dave Franco's house, and she fucking grabs him and smashes his face on the coffee table so hard. And then every other movie would do is they would just show the outline of the body down and just show the character's reaction. Not this one. This one goes all the way and shows a shot of his mangled whatever's left of his hanging off his body. Yes. And the amount of times that Kristen Stewart, that there should have almost been like in the future, I feel like we need to invent a drinking game for this movie in terms of how many times Kristen Stewart has to dispose of a body in a rug. Like it's insane the amount of bodies that she has to do. And I'm like, oh, this is just going to be the
and
first
all the
of
cleaning
many.
That she does with, you know, the scrubbing. And then like there was the tooth that was found. Oh my God.
Yeah.
And I remember like when that moment happened. Like a friend of the channel, Ryan McGuire, of course, he like said to me, he's like, did you see his jaw? And I was like, no. And then they showed, I was like, holy fuck.
Yeah.
That is like
I was
the
like,
most gruesome thing I've seen in a movie in a long time.
Yeah. Holy I mean, you want to take show, crazy. Don't tell to the next level. I mean, God damn, that's it. That's it.
It was
right
effective
there.
Though. I
oh
mean,
yeah.
Hell.
Oh yeah. So they dispose of the body, and like I said, naturally, you know that we all know that, again, as loyal movie fans who understand how movies work, that this is not nearly going to be the end. So unfortunately, like I said, this brings both Jackie and Lou into being coerced by Lou's father and also by the FBI, who are not in this movie that much, but do like establish that they have a presence throughout as they are trying to get to Lou's father, Lou Sr., who has had, you know, a couple years of, you know, basically running the town's crime syndicate, shipping out guns, drugs, what have you. You know, he's got all the cops on his local payroll. And a thing that's established about Lou's character, Kristen Stewart's character, is that she's been helping him commit all these murders. But you know, obviously she you know, does not want to do it anymore. She has, you know, that there's allusions to the fact of, you know, that their mother walked out of them and you don't actually know if he killed her or not. So that's referenced a couple of times. And yeah, so like I said, you have this kind of whirlwind odyssey that revolves. You know, like I said, there's not too much to talk about as far as, you know, the semblances of the plot, because like I said, this is a very traditional like noir setting, but in terms of like how this kind of improves on and adds more to the genre, I thought was pretty fascinating as well, especially given that, you know, at the end, like, I mean, we're going to talk about the ending for sure, because the ending is really kind of what throws it off, and I'm not quite sure where it goes. But I mean, I wanted to talk about a couple of other sequences as well that I thought were pretty impressive. So obviously, again, just the cinematography and the editing that's done when it shows like kind of the flashback dream sequences to them killing all everybody and throwing them into that canyon where they dispose of Dave Franco's body, I thought was really, really cool. The Vegas scene. Oh, man. Like, that was, I mean, I don't even know where to start with that.
I think that's like one of the best scenes, like, you know, of a montage that I've seen this year or in a while, I must say. Yeah. You know, that glamorizes that.
It incorporates everything. It incorporates, like I said, the drug addiction, the lack of feeling isolated and disconnected. Because the thing about Jackie's character is that Jackie is somebody who, again, is one of those people who wants love really badly but doesn't know how to find it because she's been shown so little of it. You know, and that's why, again, I wish we had had more of a backstory in order to provide context for it, because the movie is leaving a lot open for the audience to kind of figure out, you know, because we know so much about Lou's character and her backstory growing up and why she is the way she is. But we've only got like a little bit as far as what they want us to guess about Jackie. And so that's kind of like, it's not really a flaw. I guess you could say it's more of a nitpick, but like the fact that kind of we do have this push-pull back and forth over Jackie's character where she's meant to be more of this force, this presence, but she clearly does have this very rich and interesting and tragic backstory that we only get a slight glimpse of. So there's that, and it's all kind of summarized in the Vegas scene where, again, she's looking to escape whatever life it is that she has left behind, and she thinks that this Vegas thing, this bodybuilding competition, you know, becoming strong and, you know, and viewing is the key to escape. And really all it does is it exposes her vulnerability even more when she kind of ODs on the steroids and vomits on stage, you know, in a sequence that is, again, very, very harrowing, where she, in her mind, vomits up she vomits up Lou. In this crazy, trippy dream mindset. So, like, I guess that's why the ending, I don't, like, straight up hate it, because the movie, it's not like the movie doesn't have a bunch of sequences that are alluding to, like, you know, crazy hallucinatory dream sequences and everything. I guess it's just the fact of how the ending plays it, at least for a while, so straight before the cops show up. That's what kind of throws it off. But like I said, it's how the movie utilizes montage and different, like, body horror moments as metaphor, I think, is probably the biggest takeaway and the most interesting aspect. Nathaniel, what do you think about that?
Well, yeah, I also wanted to comment, like, I kind of agree, but I also kind of like the fact that we don't exactly know much about her, because, I mean, one, she is, you know, an extremely well-written character of what's there, but I kind of like the idea. It's like, was this sort of inside her the whole time? Is this something that she's always been, or it? Thing?
Another pun intended thing?
Yeah. Inside of her.
What? It was inside of her.
Well, that's the thing, like, because I'm trying to, like, describe sort of, like, exactly how she would be this way, because part of me feels like, sorry, I'm blanking now. It's going to come back.
It'll come back.
But. Yeah, no, but I think it kind of makes you question whether, like, she would have acted this way had it not have been for the steroids. Like, is this something? Because even though, like, they do insinuate her backstory is, like, pretty tragic, and I think I kind of know the reason why, there's still a little bit of ambiguity there to really make you question what she's all about. So I kind of love that a little bit, but it would have been nice to maybe get like a little, like maybe one more morsel. Yeah.
And I mean, especially given the, like, the one thing that we do find out about her is that she is, she's not exactly, queasy when it comes to killing people, as you know, considering the, considering the sheer amount of bodies that she drops in the movie alone. I mean, it's kind of insane.
High body count.
Very, very high body count. You know, like I said, so I think that's another reason why her and Lou kind of find themselves as these kindred spirits, because again, they're, you know, they both are no strangers to killing people, unfortunately, you know, and
two sides of the same coin.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Could not agree more. So there's one other thing that I wanted to talk about as well, which is we have not talked about one performer in the movie who I think is maybe the scene stealer of the whole movie. Because, you know, again, we talked about, obviously, Stuart O'Brien, Ed Harris, Jenna Malone, Dave Franco. We did not talk about Anna Baryshnikov's character. That means Daisy. Which is a character that when you start off is like, what the hell is this character? Like, she's just going to be this ditzy blonde. And then her character ends up kind of being a lot more important than you would have thought.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of makes the consistency with the performance that much more like, she's just such this crazy mix of like, she's terrifying and gross, but at the same time, mm-hmm. she is just like this very sweet, naive soul who does just want to mm-hmm. be loved and kind of probably sees this connection with Kristen Stewart because she's probably the only other lesbian in the whole town. Yeah. So she's probably like, oh, she's the only, we're kind of like destined to be soulmates. And she's kind of like got this, you know, mentality. And Kristen Stewart clearly like wants nothing to do with her, but kind yeah. of like just tolerates her because she feels bad for her. And then obviously later on that takes a turn and then resulted one of the most shocking, but also like just gut punch deaths ever. Like when, so obviously death. When,
yes,
when Katie, when Jackie flees to Vegas and has her incident and then Lou Senior, Ed Harris, picks her up after she ends up in jail there for beating her up. Meanwhile, back in wherever they are, Lou is basically forced to, after they, after Daisy spotted them, after they were, moving Dave's Franco's body and car out, Daisy ends up spotting them and is able to pretty quickly figure out that like they were the ones that killed him. And so she basically threatens Lou by saying that she's going to go to the cops over it. And so that causes her dad, Lou Senior, to contract Jackie to kill her. And the way that the sequence in which she shoots and kills Daisy is mind blowing oh. because the way that it's done is just, oh my God. Like, it's just such a shocker. And like yeah. it cuts away. You just hear the gunshot sound and the blood. See, these are the parts where I'm like, yeah, the horror and the utilization of jump scares yeah. in a non-horror setting it's absolute genius. It is mm-hmm. absolute right. freaking genius. And I loved it. That was a moment where like there was just an audible gasp in my yeah. theater, and it was freaking great.
And dude, the scene that follows.
Yeah. Oh
like
yeah.
With razor. The FBI,
yeah. 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 Yeah, another body that Lou has to clean up, and then and roll into a rug, and then that pretty much leads us into the ending because there's not really much that happens before like the actual ending scene, yeah. which is where like you know, she basically says, oh yeah, she's gonna sell her dad out to the cops, and her dad basically contracts the one police guy to go and kill her. That doesn't work, so she ends up going to her dad's place to free Jackie, and she frees Jackie, and then she's about to kill her dad. Her dad ends up shooting her in the leg and has her done. And then, I mean, who wants to explain the ending here? Cause I'm still trying to figure out exactly like what it is. Cause I mean, Kristen, do you want to take this one? Cause
I don't even know where to start.
Right.
Well,
like,
okay. So we have, okay, so somehow we just transform from Love Lies Bleeding to Attack of the 50-foot Woman. I was like, huh?
Yeah.
I feel like me and a lot of people were confused in the theater. You know, like, why did this just turn take it? Is it genius? I don't know. Is it great? I don't know. For me, that ending where we see just like Kate turn into like the tall woman that she is.
And she becomes a giant out of nowhere. She literally turns into like Giganta from DC.
And it kind of like hints to that, like, you know, she's less like, you know, where she's like, you know, is running away and, you know, Lou is just like, you know, fighting for her life. And she turns around to go back and she's like, her like transforming, her body is starting to change, you know, the body horror elements, you know, are kicking in with, you know, I guess with all the steroids. But, I don't know if this was like a thing where it was like, say no to steroids, because and if you do, come into the Attack of the 50-foot Woman.
Yeah, I mean, so I think that what we had here was a case of they were trying to sum up all the different metaphors of the movie in kind of
one
giant unintended metaphor, and I think there was something that was a little bit lost in translation, where throughout the movie, right, you have like them hinting at like, you know, Jackie's, you know, a lot of close-ups of Jackie's muscles as they're bulging, you know, with the constant over usage of the steroids, and then at the end, right, Lou's about to go and confront her dad. You hear her screaming off in the distance. And Jackie all of a sudden like goes through like she's about to transform into the Hulk. All of a sudden where she lurches over in pain, her muscles start growing and whatnot. And you see like Lou being held at gunpoint by her dad. And then all of a sudden Jackie, who is now 50 feet tall, comes in, grabs Lou Senior and pins him down And I was so confused. I'm like, what the hell is about to happen? Like, yep. Is she about to shove him in her vagina? Is she about to eat
him? Oh, God. Is she about to rip his heart out?
I don't think so.
I didn't know what to expect because I saw, of all the things that I was expecting to happen, I was not expecting that. I thought she was just going to come in, beat up Ed Harris and brutally murder him the way that she did with Dave Franco's character. That's what I thought was going to happen. Did not expect that that was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then she kind of just sits there and has him pinned down. And next thing you know, it shows her and Lou running through the clouds, and they're both 50 feet tall before it cuts to them in the truck driving away. And I'm like, so was this supposed to be a metaphor? Was this a hallucination? Because obviously, again, as a summation of the metaphor and the message of the movie, right, the steroid usage as well as the overt masculinity, femininity, indecision, I guess you could say, that's been felt by Jackie's character throughout the whole movie. That I got, and it's like, okay, like, she's made her decision, she's both, and all that, and she's going to be with Lou regardless. That I got.
Mm-hmm.
But the actual presentation and execution of it, confusing to say the least, especially when you have the scene after that when they're driving away and all of a sudden there's a thump in the trunk, and I'm like, oh wait, that's right, they didn't have time to dispose of Daisy's body.
Yeah,
but you hear a thump and you go over and they pull over to the side of the road, they open the trunk, and Daisy, who has been shot in the face, by the way, but it must have been one of those where the bullet grazed the cheek but it didn't actually kill her because it must not have hit her brain, is still alive. So then you just kind of have her, like, kind of, like, just tiredly strangling her. And then you just see them, like, dragging the body off into the distance. And, like, I don't know if, like, that's supposed to be a joke or whatnot. Because, again, the movie, the Daisy character, the movie does not seem to know whether they want Daisy to be, like, a tragic character or more of, like, a threat. But that was the moment where I'm like, okay, what are we doing here, guys?
I just saw Daisy as a threat, to be fair.
Yeah,
I didn't see her as like a tragedy or anything like that. She had everything connected of what we saw in the end with, you know, between what Katie was doing and Lou was doing, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't see her as a tragic. I just see her as, you know, just a target for what could be disaster for the two characters. So that's why.
Yeah.
But I just want to say something about the ending too. Like, I think what really could have been a cool ending is if, you know, she was just not as tall as it was. And I was thinking, like is she going to rip his limbs off?
Right. That's
like,
what
that
would have
been,
happen.
Like, really cool. That like, even cool. elevated the body horror for that. Yeah. Like, I would have been all over that. Like, that would have been, like, a really solid ending. You know, and maybe, like, the size of, like, what She-Hulk is, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
Like, that's what
or
I was.
Or, like, a more monstrous.
Yeah, like, a, you know, like, you know, Mark Ruffalo style, you know, Hulk. And, like, I think it takes away from what audiences wanted or like with the themes that it, you know, it tries to push for. And I feel like when I was watching Chris Stuckman's review, he praised the ending. And I know he was like, you know, some audiences are going to be like, you know, mixed on it. And I feel like now that it's released, like, you know, wide with the audience, I saw a lot of people were not happy with that ending. And I appreciate the ambition for it. But I was like, it's not selling what it wants to sell in the end.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. Because the problem that I have when it comes to things like this is that I think that what can happen is you can have a situation where the metaphor gets a little, you try to physicalize the metaphor a little bit too much. And like I said, and that can sometimes cause the meaning and intent of what you're trying to go for can get a little lost and muddled and confused. That would be my criticism of it.
Well, here's the thing. Do you mind if I go off for like 5 minutes?
Oh, please do. Oh, please do. Oh, please do. I can tell you've been sitting on this one.
I've been thinking about this for the past day, and I've, you know, talked to other people about this as well. But because I agree to an extent where I think the presentation of it, the way the because it's a very, not pun intended, but the way it's a very physical reaction, like the way she's interacting with Lou Senior sort of thing. So that does make me question the metaphorical sense of it. But what I think the ending is going for is, you know, Lou sees
Jackie.
What's her name again? Jackie. Yeah, Jackie. I knew it started with J. That's how she sees her, like this big giant sort of like hero in her life. You know, even though she's caused all this to happen. She's essentially the one there to save her, because she gives her that choice: are you going to kill your father or become better than him? And she chooses to take the high road, right? And so I love that, because then the scene of them both like going off into the clouds, you know, they're both like giants. It's sort of like surreal and like, oh, this is like the happy ending, you know, that they sort of deserve. But then you get that cut back to reality with her in the trunk, because at first I wasn't sure. And also keep in mind, they showed Gulliver's Travels on TV earlier in the film.
That's so right. I forgot about that. They did foreshadow it. Because
I've seen that movie. I'm like, oh, Gulliver's Travels, you know? And I didn't even think about it until after the fact.
Yeah.
But when you get back to the trunk, her in there, because I was like, is this
it's a pretty hard conflict, too, also. Yeah, the scene in the clouds to the trunk.
Right, because them driving away, that could have been a nice ending, but here's the thing, like, because I was like, is this in direct conflict with what just happened? But it might not be, because I heard this great interpretation my friend has, where he's basically saying, like, this moment is kind of like a snap back to reality, that she has, like, the reality of the situation is, it's like, it's never going to be perfect, and they, like, what other choice do they have than to get rid of her? And that kind of reflects the reality of where they are. And also, I also love the detail, because when we were sitting there, my buddy Ryan was like, when she gives her the cigarette earlier, he's like, oh, right. I quit. Yep. Like, that's going to come back. And then at the end, she's smoking it. She's disposing of her body.
Yep.
And I'm like,
yeah, that was,
it's so tight. It's great.
I think I will agree. I like that part where it comes back to reality. I think that, you know, is solid enough. I think it's just for me, when we have that final conflict, like, I don't mind them running in the clouds and whatever. I thought that was a little cute moment for them.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Sure. It's distracting. I get it. Because I feel like it could play better for me when I see it. I could definitely see my rating of this going up, like, for sure, like, top 10 of the year. I really, really do feel that. But, yet again, like, I would have preferred something a bit more transformation, like even turning into like a werewolf or something, like even that would have been like, okay, like I understand it's a bit more than her just like upscaled to like 50 feet.
I get it. Yeah, then like I said, the metaphor made sense. It's just, it was jarring the way that it was inserted into the movie.
Yes.
And so like I said, that's why it's more of a nitpick than a straight up critique, because I'm not saying it didn't work. It did. It accomplished what it was going for. It was just jarring. is really it. So
right, I agree with that.
Yeah. So like I said, so like I said, I'm just gonna give a quick 5 minutes just talking about Invincible as well, and then we'll come back to this and give our star ratings and thought processes. So in addition to this weekend, we also had the return of Invincible as well, the second four episodes of the 8-episode second season that was announced last year. The first four episodes aired in November, and we are here almost 4 months later with the second four episodes of season four. And I wanted to talk to you guys about this, less so about Invincible and more so about this structure, because this is an issue that I've been noticing has really started to affect TV, which is the long gaps in between seasons. Not only the long gaps between seasons, but seasons that, like, apparently can't even finish their runs. Because this is an issue that you saw pop up with, like, there were a lot of shows that would do this, where they would split their last season up into two parts and call it part one and part two, even though they really were separate seasons of TV. Sopranos did this. Breaking Bad did this. Mad Men did this. BoJack Horseman did this. A bunch of other shows that I'm currently forgetting about. But the reason why I feel like it's hurting it is because you're seeing so many shows now, and it's so easy for shows to get lost in the shuffle, that when you have a show that actually is worth watching and is actually worth talking about, it can be frustrating when you sometimes have to wait 2 to 3 years in between each for season. And I understand, again, these shows are big, they're massive, they're expensive, production budgets, production schedules, everything that recently happened with the strike and everything. But I really do think it is to the detriment of these shows. And Robert Kirkman talked about this. He's like, oh, it was only because we were still hard at work on season three and we wanted to release it closer back to back. I'm like, but that doesn't track. That doesn't make sense. You know, like, you could have still been working on season three and still released the rest of season two. You know, I think that what happened was is they saw where the story ended and in that fourth episode, and like, oh, this could be a natural cutoff point. And I think that they were limited by the strike. But I wanted to get your guys' thoughts. Chris, and I know you watch more TV than Nathaniel. Nathaniel, I know you don't watch TV, as much TV, but I do think there was something to be said where, again, so we're getting Arcane and Severance back this year, both shows that aired their first seasons It'll been 2 years since the last season of Severance. It'll been 3 years since the last season of Arcane. By the time Peacemaker season two comes out, it'll have been 3 years, you know? And I guess the difference is that, right, the reason why I bring this up is because say what you will about Game of Thrones, but Game of Thrones, the biggest and most expensive show for a decade, still had new seasons that came out every year up until the last couple of seasons, you know? And TV, again, has all the strength of TV has always come from the familiarity of it. The fact that, again, you had to, again, it was always coming back, but it would be there at a certain time and then go away. Now, again, you have shows that leave and you don't know when they're coming back, if at all. And, like, I'll admit, I sound a little bit like a spoiled fan, but, like, it is frustrating to say the least because I feel like I can't even get attached to shows anymore. Now, not just because I don't know if they're going to cancel them or not, because I don't know how long I'm going to have to wait until the next season.
Yeah,
you know?
It gets forgotten about in the distance because, like you said, there is so much content everywhere because, like, you can kind of see that when Barry, like, the last two seasons of Barry release, we had, like, this, like, two-year break. We weren't getting Barry. And then, you know, we had the one release right after like COVID and then the final season that just aired last year.
Right.
You know, it's like, you know, if you look at some of the viewership for that, it went down.
It did. Not to mention the fact that it also affected the writing of that show as well, because I thought that while Barry's third season, which they had completed writing that prior to COVID happening, because that was one of the first shows that got delayed because of COVID.
Yep.
The fourth season, I thought, suffered heavily as a result of it because they tried to include a time jump that really kind of came out of nowhere and made no sense. You know, and like I said, that kind of goes back to COVID and the amount of shows that were delayed, obviously. But I mean, you talk about some of the other ones. I mean, so by the time this new season of The Boys comes out, it'll have been 2 years since the last season. Now, we had Gen V kind of in between to kind of cushion that. House of the Dragon, it'll have been 2 years since that last season. Andor, we don't know if we're getting that back this year or next year, but it'll have been, if it comes out next year, it'll have been 3 years since that season. Freaking Stranger Things, besides the fact that season four already got delayed because of COVID, you know, and all those kids are now grown up. They're not even in their teens anymore. They're like early 20s
they're like
now.
Adults.
No. Yeah, they're straight up young adults. The final season of Stranger Things is coming out next year. These kids are going to be freaking like 22, 23 by the time this show comes out.
I feel like the only show that remained consistent that was a hit that really people were like glued to every week and were happy to see it come back is Succession. I feel like that was the one where, you know, you go by the year. I know there was like, you know, 1 year they didn't air it like 1 year. I forgot which year it was, but it was like, you know, they.
The way that it goes is they had seasons one and two were back to back in 2018 and 19, and then you have the delay because of COVID. But they were
consistent at least. Right, they were consistent, delivering audiences and people wanted. You
right,
know?
Exactly, because they knew they had like a hit on their hands, and their whole thing was like, okay, they knew that when they were filming season three, they're like, we have got to get this out. Like this is priority number one, and they got that out like as soon as White. Done. They aired Succession in fall of 2021, and then because of the extensive shoot for season four, the final season, and especially once they revealed that it was going to be the final season, that one didn't premiere until spring of 2023. It was March of 2023 that aired, but at the very least,
it's pretty consistent enough where it wasn't delayed by another year. It wasn't delayed by nothing. You can even say that now with The Bear. The Bear went into production. Season two happened right away. And now it just got released that, you know, season three is being filmed like back to back with season four, you know?
Thank not goodness. To mention that.
Back to back?
They announced this like there was a leak or something.
But, it wasn't a leak. It was an official news story.
I wasn't sure.
And as far as The Bear goes, The Bear, because the way that they shoot that show, the way that they shoot and edit it, like they're shooting it and editing it as they're filming it at the same time. So the turnover rate on that show is it's pretty good. Not to mention the fact that like their days aren't super long. And the fact that like, because they have like a lot of material to work with, because the idea and the vision of that show is so consistent. Like again, it makes for a better workflow. And that I think is the other thing too, also that needs to be said as well, because so many of these productions are so massive. Right? Turnover time between all of the locations, all the shooting, all the editing is ridiculously insane, you know? So that's another thing that needs to be considered. But I guess bringing it back to Invincible, what was so interesting is the reception to it, where people said, this is the first time I'd heard this in a while, where the quality is still there, obviously. Anybody who watches the show knows that it's one of the best if not one of the best animated shows. It's between that and Legend of Vox Machina and Arcane, probably, as far as like the three best animated shows right now that have kind of risen up to take BoJack's place. But people were saying that, like, yeah, it was so long in between, even though it had only been since November. They're like, yeah, it felt like it was so long since the last season that they thought that it hurt it. You know, even though the quality is still there, they're like, or do we really still care? And I thought that was pretty interesting, because when the first season of Invincible dropped back in spring of 2021, like, that was a massive, massive hit when that came out. Like, that was a phenomenon, especially in the dread, because that was still like in peak COVID times too. So like, we were just happy to be happy to have what we had as well. So so that was kind of like my two cents, because again, it was a like I said, I watched the new episode. It was a really, really good episode. Picked up right where we left off at the end of the first half of the first four back in November. But Nathaniel, I just wanted to get your take on that as well. You know, like I said, I know you don't watch as much TV, but I know that you've watched some as well. So
yeah, well, I'm glad, because actually I'm a little versed in this topic as late. I've seen the first few episodes of season one of Invincible, and it's amazing. Like, that might be the greatest pilot of all time.
It's up there. It's pretty
good. First episode of Invincible. It's pretty amazing. And I still have to go through, but I heard about the stoppage in between, and it's like, what, we have to wait all this time, right? And I wanted to bring up the bear, because you know me with TV, I'm not always like up to date.
It happens, but especially because there's so much of it.
Yep.
But the bear just finished all the way. Like, that's a series I have completed just like the other day. I finished season two, and it is quite frankly so my favorite. It's like my favorite TV show of all time.
It's up there. Like, it's up there. That, I know everybody loves the Fishes episode, and the Fishes episode is great. It is phenomenal. But that Forks episode, man, that hits me right here.
The last episode of the second season might be the greatest episode of television I've ever seen. Like, that completely knocked me on my ass. I was sobbing during that episode.
Yeah.
I'm like, this show is unfucking believable. And the thing that's so great about it, especially for someone like me, who I like to, you know, I like to watch narratives that conclude within like 1.5 to 3 hours sort of thing. But the bear, it's not only one, are the episodes fairly short, besides, you know, of course, the Fishes episode, which is also one of the best episodes in the history of television, maybe the best directed.
That's one of the most tense hours of my life.
Yeah,
that episode.
Oh my goodness.
It's a good hour where it's just like, eyes glued with so many talent in the room.
Oh yeah. And half the talent that, like, you didn't even know was like, I figured that, like,
what?
Right, like yeah, I knew.
Like, when Jamie Lee Curtis just shows up, exactly. I'm like, what are you doing here?
My story with that is, I saw that Odenkirk was, because they had made the big announcement, right, with that Odenkirk was going to be in it. So I was like, okay, cool. And then, like, I figured that, like, okay, it's a flashback episode, so Berntal's going to be back and everything, and how they had Oliver Platt. But then I'm like, wait a minute. I'm like, what the hell? I'm like, Julia Jacobs? I'm like, what? She wasn't here before. I'm like, Jamie Lee. Like, so then you had John Mulaney and Sarah Paulson. I'm like, what the fuck? I'm like, what is going on?
I'm like, where did this family come
from? And then Jamie Lee Curtis. I was like, what is going on here? Like,
yeah. And that's the thing. Like, that one episode, like, besides that, and it also helps that it's like one of the best episodes of television, right? But the show's like 30 minutes or under for the most part. So it's like, you can breeze, not only can you breeze through it, but the consistent rate that they're turning the show out, it keeps people coming back in. And we've seen the success of the show at the Emmys. And I swear, it is going to sweep the Emmys once again.
Oh, yeah.
Without question. I'm going to make the prediction right now that Jeremy Allen White is going to win his second Emmy. I'm not sure about Eben Moss Bacharach and Iowa Devery, but, like, him specifically, he's going to win.
After Forks, Eben Moss Bacharach better fucking
There's a good chance. But I definitely think Jamie Lee Curtis and John Bernthal are winning for the episode, because, yet again, not to turn this all into a discussion about the bear, but I think Jamie Lee Curtis.
I would love to have an hour discussion of the bear.
Right? Save that for when season three drops.
I'll be on for that if you want me to.
Me too.
Jamie Lee Curtis in that one episode, not only is she in it longer than her Oscar-winning turn and everything ever all at once, but she's better. And she's going, that's the best performance I've ever seen. That's the thing, like, at that, it's like, this is what she should be winning for.
Oh my
God. You know what I mean? And John Bernthal.
Think about that. But that's,
yeah.
Oh my God, dude. Bernthal with those throwing the forks at Odenkirk. I was like, dude.
I was like, whoa. Like, that dude. Face he's, like, making when he's telling him. Oh, man. We could get into that episode. But,
well, first off, can I just say the amount of Christmases that I have sat through where things like that almost happened, because that just hit the Italian in me so hard. Ooh. And second off, like, again, Berntal is always at his best when he is about to fucking lose it and blow up. Yeah. He's always when he's at his best, every time.
He's going an angry white guy who's ready with rage.
Punisher, going all the way back to Walking Dead, he is at his best when he's about to just blow up and let loose. And that is just like, you want to talk about just stretching the tension as far as you can possibly get it. I mean, good God. It's amazing, to say the least. And like I said, the fact that we are getting... So some bit of good news. We are getting The Bear Season 3, The Boys Season 4, House of the Dragon Season 2, and The Acolyte all premiering in June. June is going to be a wonderful month for television, to say the least. Like I said, I love you two so much, and I could sit here talking about The Bear for hours, but unfortunately we do have to get going. So with that being said, let's bring it back to Love Lies Bleeding and wrap this conversation up. Nathaniel, your final thoughts and star ratings on Love Lies Bleeding.
Yeah, I keep forgetting. Is it 5 or 10? Okay, a 5. Yeah, no, I think that this is one of my probably top 10 A24 movies for me. Wow. Like, I really think it's one of the best I've ever done. And I didn't expect to love it that much. I thought maybe I'd love it, but like, this really is one of the absolute best movies of the year. I'm going to review it on my channel like tomorrow. But yeah, I absolutely love this film. I cannot wait to see what Rose Glass does next. This is a film that's going to be sitting with me for a long time. I can't wait to rewatch it, probably when it comes out on video. I'll buy the Blu-ray and check it out again. But I'm going to give it a 4.5, a very high 4.5 out of 5. I just think that this is an exceptional film, razor tight, when it comes to editing, when it comes to sound design, when it comes to character writing. I just think this is what I love about like great screenplays, what you can accomplish. Sure, not everything might work, but I think thematically it all comes together by the end of the film. And yeah, I can't wait to see this movie again. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah definitely. This is something that I do want to see again in theaters for sure. Hopefully with a better sound mix than the one that I saw the first time. Yeah. Oh God. I was straining to hear the dialogue. It was bad. Kristen, your final thoughts. Oh no, it happens. Not everyone's going to be a hit. Kristen, your final thoughts and star ratings.
Well, I was impressed. Great follow-up to Rose's, previous work. Despite, the ending that I felt mixed about, I had a good time. It was a great thriller. There is no doubt in my mind that this film, I'm not sure it will be considered for like Oscar and, Golden Globe or anything like that. This is going to be straightforward, nominated for, I can guarantee you, a couple of Film Independent Spirit Awards right off the bat.
Without a doubt.
There, I see it. Like, getting it for the sound design, the screenplay, and the direction. Like, I ultimately see it there. Yeah, I thought it was a good time. I do want to watch it again. Yeah. So just to get like the feels of it again, like maybe like I'll change my mind about the ending. But yeah, solid enough for me. I don't love it as much as you, Nathaniel, but I'm going to give it like a 3 out of 5 for me.
Really? So
maybe 3.5. So kind of going back and forward on it. So
yeah, I'm probably somewhere in between you guys. Like I said, I definitely didn't love it as much as you, Nathaniel. Like I said, the ending for me was a little bit but like I said, it was a solid effort. Like I said, so much better than her first effort. I think it really showed real improvement.
Yeah,
the director really shows that she like the thing that I'll say is that Rose Glass definitely showed me that she has a very, very, very firm understanding of genre and different genres and how to mix and blend them together, which I think is kind of what helped make A24 as good as it was, is the fact that they were taking some very widely recognized and known genres and kind of mixing them and putting them on their head. And that I think is where this movie is at its best. Also great characterization, great performances. Like I said, I had a good time with this one. I'm giving this one 4 out of 5 stars. So with that being said, people, that is it. Like I said, podcast number 3 for the month of March. We'll be back next weekend. Luke and I will be breaking down Roadhouse and 3 Body Problem, and then we're going to be wrapping it the weekend after with, again, the Monkey Mayhem is only beginning. Godzilla and Kong. I think this is weirdly the second year in a row where both a Kong movie and a Planet of the Apes movie are coming out in the same year, after 2017 when we had Kong Skull Island and War for the Planet of the Apes. So I just realized that that's a weird coincidence that I just realized. So like I said, you've got all that to look forward to, as well as so much more content coming down that later on down the year. Like I said, this summer is going to be a big one. In addition to our normal summer slate, like I said, we're going to be recapping every episode of House of the Dragon Season 2. We're going to be recapping every episode of The Boys Season 4. Luke and I are kicking off Talking Lost starting in September in order to commemorate that show's 20-year anniversary. And like I said, we've got so much more content and stuff planned for you guys. All of you stay close and subscribe to the Talking TV channel. But of course, go and follow these two with everything they've got going on with their stuff. Nathaniel, where can the good people follow you on the interwebs?
Well, they can find me at Nathaniel_Ahart on most social media platforms, aka Instagram and, as I call it, Twitter. And you can follow me on YouTube at Nathaniel Ahart, of course. Got a lot of movie reviews going on there. About to start the countdown for the top 50 albums of the 50s with Johnny Radio next week, actually. So it's really sneaking up on us. Crazy. But yeah, so it should be really, really fun to get into. And yeah, so many movie reviews coming out soon as well. A lot of great independent films to talk about still, and just great films in general. And I'm excited to see what 2024 has in store for us.
Yes, absolutely. And Kristen, where can the good people follow you on the interwebs?
You can find me at Miss Flamingo, the little thing here. Says it right there. Go follow me at Miss Flamingo on Instagram. You can follow me on Twitter at K Flamingo. I'm also the co-host of the M&K Productions podcast with my best friend, Mac. Shout out to Mac. He'll be on here, I know, soon to talk. What is it? The Fall Guy. You know,
The Fall Guy. And before that,
it's coming out.
He will be on to talk about The Fall Guy. Yes. And I believe I also got him on for a couple of episodes in April as well, potentially to talk about Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare when that comes out. Cannot freaking wait
that
for that.
Awesome.
That's gonna be awesome. That'll hopefully redeem Cavill after that absolute travesty that was Argyle. Because
I still want to see Argyle.
I'm not going to see it.
The less said about that, the better. Luke and I already discussed it. You guys want to know our thoughts? Go and watch the episode. But like I said, follow me with everything going on at Movie Nerd Reviews across all platforms, at Official Talking TV Podcast across all platforms. Subscribe to this channel if you haven't already. Follow us on Twitch. This episode will be available on Spotify and Apple Podcasts tomorrow. And as always, people, 12 seasons in a short film, and watch more fucking movies. We'll see you guys next time.